The protein China wants. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. If there is a trade war between the U.S. and China, America's soybean farmers will be right in the middle of it. And China is a huge market for them.
When something like this that's completely outside of our control gets in the way, it's really frustrating.
Also, a British village is losing its battle against coastal erosion, and this young woman is getting ready to lose the family home.
It's kind of upsetting to know that all this will be gone by the time that I get anywhere close to having like a family of my own.
Plus, a director from Finland wants his country to pay attention to his new movie.
I really did make it as a challenge, really, for mainstream Finland to acknowledge the diversity that exists within the country.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us today. We've got questions, so many questions, lots of basic ones, actually, about Trump's tariffs, and in a couple of minutes, some answers. But first, what is it like being caught in the middle of this budding trade war between the U.S. and China, say, if you're a farmer? Because in retaliation for Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum from China, China is threatening to jack up tariffs on 106 U.S. products. We've spoken about the tariff on pork, but another significant hit that American farmers could take is China's proposed 25% tariff on soybeans. Grant Kimberly is a sixth-generation Iowa farmer. He's also director of market development for the Iowa Soybean Association. You may remember us speaking with Grant about Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit to his family soybean farm in 2016. Well, Grant recently got back from a trade mission to China, and he joined us from Ankeny, Iowa. I asked him if he talked about the possibility of a trade war with Chinese buyers and others in the industry there.
Yeah, we did have the opportunity to be in China when all of this started to take form. And, you know, this has not been a surprise to either side of the industry, whether it's the buyers in China or the marketers and sellers of soybeans here in the United States. We've known that this has been brewing. And so it was a topic of discussion that we had with the industry over there. And we've been working in China for 35 plus years. So we have long established relationships with our customers in China. And so that allows us the ability to have really open and forthright conversations. And so we talked about this, and we've been telling both of our governments that this is not the right way to address these different challenges and concerns that both countries have regarding trade. Unfortunately, when trade disagreements and trade wars start being talked about, it seems agriculture is always right in the middle of it. Nobody wins in a trade war. Farmers of the United States would lose, and the consumers of China would also lose.
I mean, how much do you think the governments are listening to you, other farmers, your Chinese counterparts? How far do those good relations actually go to buffer you from any hits you might take?
Well, you know, it's going to be a challenge, but we have advocates for us who have the ears of the key leaders. And one of those advocates is Ambassador Terry Branstad. The former governor of Iowa is the U.S. ambassador to China, and he has a good personal 35-year relationship with the president of China, President Xi Jinping, and he also has, I think, the respect of President Trump. So I think people like him will insert calm into the conversation eventually and help both sides maintain open and good dialogue to get this issue resolved.
Grant, give us the background here. Just how important is China as a customer for soybean farmers like yourself in Iowa and the U.S.?
Well, it's really important. China, by far and away, is the largest purchaser of soybeans in the world. And China buys a little over 30% of all the soybeans grown in the United States. So they are a really important customer. The soybean industry is very dependent on exports. We grow a lot more than what we can utilize in the United States. So we want to maintain access to free and fair trade around the world. And China is the leading market for us.
And I gather the numbers were expected to grow this year, right?
Yeah, China's already purchasing 93 million metric tons of soybeans this last year, and that annual growth should continue by another 3 million metric tons a year, every year, almost through the next decade is what the projections show.
You know, I was wondering if soybeans are one of the main things in pigs' diets, and pork, we hear, is also going to get slapped with a tax from China. Are there knock-on effects that you're concerned about that the rest of us might not see?
Yeah, pork production is one of the biggest demand drivers for soybeans, as is poultry production, aquaculture production, and lots of other smaller industries too. So there's always these trickle-down effects, I guess you could say, between the various markets. And we don't want to see tariffs on pork. We don't always see tariffs on anything else because they all kind of reverberate back to one another and impact the prices that farmers receive.
So when we see these headlines, China proposing this 25% tax on American soybeans, is that how you find out about it? Do you get any warning or letter or email from the U.S. government that starting on X date, your pricing is going to change?
No, we don't get any warning, unfortunately. We have good advocates through our Iowa congressional delegation and our current governor, Kim Reynolds, and we are in communication with them quite regularly. They, of course, are in communication with other folks at the federal government. So sometimes we might get a little bit of a heads up when something like this is coming down the pike, but usually we hear about it just like everybody else in the media.
So as you told us, Grant, over the years, your family farm has established some fairly close connections with China. Does all this feel personal?
Yeah, I mean, it's personal in several ways because this is such a critical part of our overall business model, really, as Iowa and U.S. farmers and my own personal farm. And our mission is to grow food to feed people and feed livestock that feeds people. And so, you know, I've developed these relationships with our key customers around the world. A lot of them have come to my farm and I've hosted them here in Iowa. And you build up a relationship and you have a common goal and a common interest. And when something like this that's completely outside of our control gets in the way, it's really frustrating, you know, and it's frustrating for the people we work with too. So it's something that we all feel a little helpless on, but at the same time, we can continue to tell the key decision makers, get our message out there that this affects a lot of people's lives and we need to get these issues resolved sooner than later.
Grant Kimberly, an Iowa soybean farmer and director of market development for the Iowa Soybean Association. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Okay, now let's get down to the nitty-gritty on those tariffs themselves. My colleague Carol Hills has a lot of curiosity questions about how tariffs actually work. So she got in touch with Emily Blanchard, a trade policy expert at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, and went down her list.
Emily, my first question, going back to the case of the U.S., why is President Trump able to impose tariffs without congressional approval?
It's not a unilateral power. At this point, the president has to use one of a few special clauses that are buried in various trade acts that allows him to take unilateral power without checking with Congress first. So in this most recent set of about $50 billion of imports that Trump has promised to impose tariffs on from China, he's calling on something called Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974 that allows the president to either threaten, as President Trump has done, to impose tariffs unilaterally to change another country's behavior, or it can use retaliatory tariffs in response.
And are these seen as retaliatory tariffs?
Well, yes. So these initial tariffs proposed by Trump are retaliation for intellectual property rights violations that the Trump administration is claiming Chinese firms and, to some extent, the government has engaged in.
But Congress also can impose tariffs.
Yes.
So I want to get to implementing this tariff, the Chinese tariff, and let's focus on soybeans. So the tariff is, by nature, the cost of that is absorbed by the soybean farmer. It's not passed along to the Chinese consumer or purchaser.
The cost of a tariff is shared between consumers and firms, between those who are doing the importing and the buying and the exporter. And how much is shared between the consumer versus the producer depends on how elastic is demand and how elastic is supply.
That's what confuses me. It seems like China imposing a tariff would impose costs on Chinese consumers. Or do we assume they'll find a different market to buy their soybeans from?
It depends on the product. So you're right. Any country imposing a tariff is going to hurt its consumers to some extent. The question is how much? And for a product that is demanded very inelastically and for which there aren't other potential suppliers around the world to turn to, we would expect the consumers' prices to rise a lot. Potentially to 100% of that tariff cost will be borne by consumers. Other products, you may see the prices rise not much at all because there are other foreign markets and foreign suppliers.
Let's focus on soybeans, though. What is that inelastic? Therefore, the Chinese depend on the American soybeans, so they will buy them.
Good question. Short answer is I don't know. That said, what we can say is soybeans are a commodity, and there's a world price of soybeans. And that price is now going to be different for U.S. firms who want to sell into China to the extent the prices are being set in China, the U.S., but there are many, many suppliers around the world, like out of Brazil, like out of Australia, then the U.S. farmers would be disadvantaged. If it were just one U.S. farmer who had to pay this tariff, then the U.S. farmer would be in real trouble. But I do expect the prices of soy in China to rise a bit because the U.S. is such a massive supplier of soybeans worldwide. So the U.S. has what's called market power.
In China, who is buying the American soybeans? Is it the government? Is it large Chinese farmers?
It's Chinese firms, and ultimately it's Chinese consumers. So soy is used to make a lot of products, and it's also consumed directly. And so it's both.
If, say, a Chinese buyer ordered a whole bunch of soybeans from an American farmer, the order's placed, but they haven't been paid for yet, will they be grandfathered? Or if they're paid for after the tariffs are imposed, they have to include the tariff?
It's a great question. Devil's in the details. Again, I don't know. And I think the uncertainty here is one of the most important things that we sometimes forget to talk about. The fact that so many firms don't know when these tariffs will take place, we don't know how they would be applied going forward or on existing orders of inventory, this is all creating more uncertainty, which makes it harder for firms to do business in the world.
If you're a Chinese buyer of soybeans and you hear about the Chinese, your government imposing tariffs on American soybeans, do you think, oh, this is terrible for me? Or do you think, oh, this is fine because it's just the American producers who have to absorb this?
In the case of soybeans, I think, again, consumers will be a little bit less worried in China because soy is a commodity and there are lots of other potential suppliers in the world. If you don't buy it from an American farmer, chances are you can find a Brazilian farmer or another farmer, even in China, who can sell you the same product and will sell you the same product, maybe increasing the price a little bit, but not too much. But if we talk about a different product that's highly differentiated, if you are a Chinese firm that specializes in selling wines from California, now you're in trouble and you'd be very worried.
Emily Blanchard is a trade policy expert at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. We've been talking soybeans and tariffs. Thanks, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before the break, a quick look at a story we'll have for you tomorrow on the show. It's about a young couple. He's a human rights activist.
My name is Montasser Yaganam. I was born in Yemen.
His wife is an activist, too.
I was born in Bronx, New York. Right now, I'm a full-time student.
They live in New York now, but 3 years ago, they were 7,000 miles away, getting ready to be married in Yemen.
The street wars broke out, and the first bomb fell from a Saudi jet.
Yemen's political crisis was suddenly a shooting war. Then countries were fighting. Millions of people were affected. Even so, the couple went ahead with the wedding.
At first, like, he comes in and everybody starts clapping and
dancing, like, doing some music, you know.
Yeah.
Overhead, fighter jets were circling.
So all of a sudden, my mom sees the planes and she freaks out because the first airstrike hit. And it was very close.
Married in Yemen in the midst of a war. It's quite a story, and it'll be on the show tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Peter Thompson is here. How you doing?
Hey, Marco.
Peter, of course, is our Livable Planet editor. That means, among other things, that he keeps his eye on all things environmental. And I got to say, Peter, whenever you come in the studio, I feel like I've got to run for cover.
Yeah, I know I'm not usually the bearer of good news, and unfortunately today is no different.
Okay, so what's going on?
Well, it's the news this week from Antarctica, which, as you know, is basically the largest block of ice in the world. Been a lot of research in recent years showing how it's melting, and it's doing it very slowly as warming water and other impacts of climate change kind of nibbles at the edge of this huge ice sheet. But like I said, so far it seemed like this melting is pretty slow and not much of a threat to add significantly to sea level rise in the short term. But the news this week is that a team of British researchers has done something that no one's been able to do before, and that is to use a satellite to look below the edge of the sea ice all around the edge of the continent. And they published their study in the journal Nature Geoscience.
And I'm guessing what they published is not very reassuring, otherwise you wouldn't be here.
Right. What they found is that the warming water hasn't just been eating away at the ice edge. It's also been eating away at the base of the ice sheets themselves, where they're attached to the bedrock. It's what geologists call the grounding line of the ice sheet. This isn't happening everywhere, but it's happening in enough places and fast enough that they say it should change how we think about the threat of melting ice from Antarctica. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is that ice loss below the surface itself is adding more water to the global ocean than we thought. But more importantly, it's making the ice sheets and the glaciers that feed them less stable, which means they may well flow into the sea a lot more quickly than we thought.
And what does all this mean for sea level rise?
Well, the whole system is incredibly complex, but one of the authors told The Guardian that this new information could mean that Antarctica could soon be losing more water to the sea than Greenland is now.
Really sobering news from down south, way down south.
Yeah, and something to think about as we listen to our next story. It's from our colleague here, Carolyn Beeler, from the Livable Planet Desk as well. It's from the UK, where coastal erosion from rising seas and bigger storms is putting more and more of the country's extensive coastline at risk, including roughly 3,000 homes and businesses over the next 50 years. Carolyn found one family whose home is among those 3,000, and she paid him a visit a couple of weeks ago to see what it means for them.
Okay, here's the world's Carolyn Beeler.
We're losing a lot of cliff. My God, I haven't seen it for a few days. Look at all that, Darcy.
Nicola Bayliss is walking along the Haysborough Cliffs with her teenage daughter, Darcy, surveying the damage from a recent storm. She points out a pile of orange clay that fell off the cliff roughly 20 feet to the beach below.
Oh, this is part of the cliff that it used to be. It's taken away quite a lot.
It's one of those blustery days where the sky and the sea are the same shade of gray, and Darcy keeps huddling into her jacket for warmth.
The last time I was down here, we had a full ramp so you could walk down.
That ramp is gone, and a path that used to hug the edge of the cliff now ends abruptly at its edge.
It's taken a huge chunk out of it. I'm used to everyone going on about the erosion down here, but when I saw it like this, I was like, oh, this is different.
The Baylisses live in a 1950s brick house, maybe 100 meters from the cliffs. When that chunk fell off, Nicola was reading in bed and says she felt her house shake.
Felt like someone slamming a really heavy door or something. It just went poof. And I was like, whoa.
Haysborough is pretty well known as a historic village that's falling into the sea. The Baylisses' neighbor, Bryony Nearup Redding, made national news several years ago when she refused to leave her bungalow, even when the bathroom hung over the edge of the cliff. News crews filmed her house finally being demolished in 2013.
As the diggers rolled into place, the view from the beach showed exactly how precarious her clifftop house had become.
Today, tourists pass the Baylisses' house when they walk from the famous cliffs toward the village's 15th century church or historic cottages.
I've had people like come up to me and go, oh, so how long have you lived here? Like, how long have you got left? And I just stand there like, I don't know now because it's so unpredictable.
Around 2000, surveyors said the house the Baylisses live in had about 150 years left. Based on erosion risk maps and losses from recent storms, Nicola thinks she's got about 25 years now, maybe less. Clive Stockton is the landlord at the village pub and spent years in local government.
In the last 26 years that my wife and I have been in this village, we've lost 36 houses, 4 businesses, the Coast Guard, the lifeboat, the public car park, the public toilets, and virtually all the beach access.
The North Sea has been eating away at these soft cliffs for thousands of years, but it started getting worse in the 1990s. That's when defenses that used to protect most of this coast collapsed here in Haysborough, and they haven't been replaced.
So we are being torn to pieces.
By 2021, England will spend over $3.5 billion to prevent flooding and coastal erosion. But the government says along large sections of the coast, that just isn't practical. So erosion will be allowed to continue unabated. Here in Haysborough, the local government can try to slow erosion down and buy residents time. But eventually, some of them are just supposed to move away from the sea. Clive Stockton doesn't think this is particularly fair.
Defence in this country is still run on the basis of a so-called cost-benefit analysis. There is no way that a rural community can get any substantial help with sea defence.
In the face of rising seas and more extreme weather, the UK Environment Agency says especially vulnerable communities like Haysborough will just have to adapt. The Baylesses get that, but this isn't just abstract government policy to them. It's the difference between having a home and eventually losing it.
Sometimes I do feel like they don't care. So much of my childhood's already disappeared from the cliffs.
That includes the village's lifeboat station, one of the first places Darcy was allowed to walk alone as a kid. More places will follow, including the living room where we're sitting drinking tea.
It's kind of upsetting to know that all this will be gone by the time that I get anywhere close to having like a family of my own. Like where we're sitting right now won't be here.
That's a big deal to her, because this house is where her dad died suddenly of an aneurysm 2 years ago. Darcy goes with me to the center of the village to point out the church.
And this is where my father's funeral was. The route we just took from my house to here, we skated all that behind the hearse.
Darcy's dad was a well-known skateboarder.
We had over like 50 skateboarders with me, and the whole coffin was covered in skate stickers, and it was very, very cool.
That church will likely disappear within Darcy's lifetime, too. She worries eventually she won't have anywhere to look when trying to remember her father's life and death.
Being able to see where it was and being able to look back on it, I won't be able to do that.
Still, she wants to move away from Haysboro when she finishes school next spring.
The sooner I get out of here, the sooner I don't have to worry as much about the danger of, obviously, the cliffs. Because of the rate it's going, I could wake up one morning and I'd be on the edge of the cliff.
On the edge of the cliff, like her neighbor was years ago. Darcy's mom, Nicola, on the other hand, says she'll stay in this house as long as she can.
Well, my husband, hi dear, this is where he died. So, you know, I'll stay here to the end. But sorry.
The UK government doesn't offer buyouts to homeowners like Nicola. She plans to move inland when she has to. Still, she's never regretted moving to this crumbling coast when Darcy was just a baby.
I would not swap any of the memories I've had in this house or in this village for anything.
For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Haysboro, England.
Tomorrow on the show, a Haysboro pub owner tries to make the most of his business before it falls into the sea. I'm Marco Werman. In Mexico, women in prison can keep their children with them up to age 6. And this woman's son is starting to realize where he is.
He'll be watching TV, the news, and they'll talk about someone who's being sent to Santa Marta prison, and he'll say, "We live there." And he'll ask, "Why do we live here?"
Growing up behind bars in Mexico. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This sort of thing isn't supposed to happen, at least according to a Pentagon directive, but Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, seems ready to deport an immigrant vet, even though the law permits non-citizen veterans who are discharged with honorable service to naturalize. The vet we're talking about is 27-year-old Zhiyong Zhu. He's been facing the threat of deportation since his recent stint in Army basic training.
Everyone else is just worried about qualifying on their rifle or how to dig a trench. He's worried about if he's going to stay in the country while he's going through training.
That's Washington Post reporter Alex Horton. Horton says Zhiyong Zhu arrived in the U.S. from China almost a decade ago. He aimed to go to college and participate in an Army program that allows foreign-born recruits with language or medical skills to receive citizenship. When that program was temporarily shuttered, Zhu enrolled in the University of Northern New Jersey. Alex Horton says Zhu thought it was a bona fide college since it touted its affiliation with the Department of Homeland Security.
DHS approved his application. He paid money to this school that ended up being an elaborate sting operation with a fake website, a fake president, a fake seal, fake administrators that were actually DHS agents. And he got all the way through the process. And he even got a driver's license with the documents that he got from this school. So when he enlisted in 2015 and later went to training, he was all doing that with the approval by the Department of Homeland Security. And it came to a big surprise to him when he was in Army basic training and he was told by one of his instructors that ICE wanted to pull him from the Army and then send him on his way back to China because they were alleging visa fraud.
And ICE found him through the sting operation, right?
ICE found him through the sting operation. They asked the Army to kick him loose. His attorney told me that the Army did not want to let him go because he was a good soldier. But DHS leaned on the Army. They eventually released him. But the timing is important here because it took him 7 months to get discharged. He had already graduated basic training. And when he was released by the Army, they issued him an honorable discharge, which then means that he can go and take that discharge and apply for naturalization. But despite that, ICE detained him for 3 weeks. He was in jail. He faced imprisonment on Veterans Day when he was a new veteran in 2016. And then flash forward to the Seattle court in April when ICE is trying to continue proceedings to deport him back to China.
So let me just get back to the chronology here. He was taken into ICE custody when President Obama was still in office. So did Obama allow DHS to set up this fake university?
Yeah, this was an Obama-era decision. But what we're talking about in 2018, now we're looking at the circumstance of the Justice Department has created incentives for immigration judges to speed up their deportation proceedings. So now there is pressure from the Justice Department and the Trump administration to quickly adjudicate these cases and maybe not stop to determine, hey, maybe this guy served his country and this is a whole big misunderstanding.
Alex, how many other foreign-born recruits are there in the U.S. military who might face deportation?
It's hard to say. So there's been over 10,000 that have enlisted in the program. So that's a good chunk. And they bring things like medical skills, like doctors, surgeons, dentists. In the Army Reserve, they basically survive by foreign-born dentists.
Wow.
So there's more than 1,000, technically, that are now facing this problem.
I mean, it sounds like a lot of these recruits or volunteers have a lot of crucial skills. Do they generally have the support of the non-immigrant soldiers in the Army?
The Army, and specifically the special operations community, very much values these people. Because, you know, when you're on a battlefield like Syria or Afghanistan, you need people who know the culture, who are from there, and who speak the languages fluently. You know, the Army has produced studies where they weigh people who speak Russian or Ukrainian or Arabic against people from the U.S. that they've trained to speak those languages, which is very costly and very time-consuming. And their test results are blown out of the water by the native-born troops, very unsurprisingly.
So since Zhu is now a former U.S. soldier, what would happen if he returns to China?
They might subject Zhu to counterintelligence screenings. They might confine him. They might target him for suspected espionage or being an American spy.
Did you meet or just chat with Zhu?
I chatted with Zhu. He's in Seattle right now for his proceedings.
Mm. What for you is like the big takeaway? What impression did you have after speaking with him?
I've spoken to a number of immigrant recruits over the last year in my reporting. And the biggest takeaway I have on these people is they're not just in it for the citizenship alone. These are people who come from countries like China, like Iraq, like Afghanistan, and they feel welcome in this country, and they feel that they have this contribution they can make. They want to repay society with their service. And this is something that gets them the American citizenship that they want, and also gives them an opportunity to do something for the country that led them in with open arms. And that is, I think, something that binds everyone together. No matter what country they come from, I always got that sense when speaking to these folks that this was something that they took pride in and they wanted to make it part of their identity.
Alex Horton with The Washington Post, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
All this week, our Across Women's Lives team has been investigating what prison life is like for women. Today, we're going to look at what it's like for incarcerated mothers. Throughout the world, it's becoming more common to find children living with their mothers in prison. Today, we're looking at one example. In Mexico, some incarcerated moms can keep their children with them until they're 6 years old. Estimates put the number of Mexican children being raised in prisons at nearly 2,000. But are the kids better off living with their moms behind bars? The World's Jasmine Garz shares the story of two families in Mexico City affected by this policy.
The thing that worries Nancy Polanco Najera is that her four-year-old son, Alexis, has started to figure it out.
He'll be watching TV, the news, and they'll talk about someone who's being sent to Santa Marta prison, and he'll say, we live there. And he'll ask, why do we live here?
He's beginning to realize that they are locked up, that they live in Santa Marta Catitla, a maximum security prison in the outskirts of Mexico City.
I got here when I was 19. Well, I practically lived my whole youth here, my whole life in prison, you know?
There's something disarming about Polanco, her soft lisp, her pink bubblegum lipstick, her childlike bangs. It's like time stood still when she was brought here as a teen. She was sentenced to 40 years with her sister and mother. They're all accused of running a kidnapping operation. She claims she was innocent and that when she was brought here...
Inside, I was destroyed. What I most wanted was to die.
When she hit her 30s, she says she started feeling really lonely. It hit her. She was never going to have children. And then she realized something else. Maybe she didn't have to be so alone.
This isn't a prison. This is like a city.
Santa Marta prison is divided between male and female inmates. Conjugal visits among them are allowed. Polanco asked a friend to introduce her to a guy. And that's how she met her boyfriend. And that's how... they made a sweet, soft, sleepy-eyed little guy, Alexis. Polanco says the pregnancy was a surprise. She was on birth control. And she realizes it might come off as selfish, bringing a little boy into this.
This is going to sound very cruel, but to be able to breastfeed your child, to be able to see life, to be able to see life grow, it gives you a different set of values.
The idea of allowing children to stay with their mothers is that kids like Alexis are better off here, with his mom, his dad, his aunts, and grandma. He gets psychological support, food, and school. The number of children living inside Santa Marta Acatitla prison fluctuates. At times it's been over 100. Right now it's around 60. It's enough that the prison has its own elementary school. In this classroom, about a dozen boys and girls are learning the Spanish language letter Che. The lesson is interrupted when a sulking little boy sticks his tongue out at a girl. An insult so terrible, it brings the entire alphabet to a halt. You know that nostalgic comfort you feel when you walk into a cozy classroom? With its tiny tables and colorful posters, this could be anywhere in the world. Except at the end of the day, these kids and their mothers will go back to their cells. And at the end of kindergarten, these kids will go back out into a world they barely know. After class, I head to the empty playground. Nancy Polanco is playing hide and seek with her son, Alexis. It's his turn to hide.
I don't know where Alexis is. I don't know. I can't see him. Who knows where Alexis is? Because he's so small, I can't see him.
In 2 years, Alexis will be permanently gone. And the problem is, everyone in the Polanco family is in prison. There's just no one left on the outside to take him. She says she talks to him about this sometimes.
I get this knot in my throat.
She says she reminds him that this is not forever, even though to her, it's starting to feel that way. What happens to boys and girls like Alexis when they leave prison? Experts I speak to say even though Mexico is incarcerating more and more women, efforts to take care of their children are haphazard at best. They often end up in orphanages with religious organizations or, if they're lucky, adopted by a family member. A few days after I visit the prison, I come to a neighborhood in downtown Mexico City to meet 8-year-old Isabel. As it turns out, she's pretty busy singing along to YouTube videos. By the way, Isabel is her middle name. Her mother was involved in a very high-profile drug case in Mexico, so the family asked me to protect her anonymity.
No lo ves cuando no...
You see things differently when they don't affect you personally.
Isabel's adoptive father, Jesus Buendia, used to be a social worker in the prison system. And at some point, someone told him about a distant relative who had been sentenced to a notoriously rough facility and had given birth there. He decided to visit, which is when he met Isabel.
Sí, yo la cargué porque se me hacía muy tierna. pero también al mismo tiempo, pues, te
yeah, I lifted her up, and I just thought she was so sweet. And at the same time, I had a lot of questions, like, why is this kid in here? She got roll called like all the other inmates. She'd get up like all the inmates. They allowed her to go for walks like all the inmates. And that gave me this tenderness, and I just thought it was so strange.
He kept on coming to see them. Isabel's mother was starting to worry about her growing up in prison. So one day, her mother told him, look, she's almost 4. She's going to have to leave soon. And she was facing the same exact problem as Alexis's family. Her immediate relatives, her mother, her sister, they were all in prison too. There was no one to take this toddler. Buendía thought about it, and he decided to legally adopt Isabel. He remembers the day he went to get her.
Y su mamá se empezó a doler un poco, empezó a caer, y hablé con ella unas palabras. Le dije, mira.
And her mother was so sad, her face fell. And I said to her, listen, the way you feel right now, that's how I'm going to feel when you come back for her. So I'm asking you to be strong. If you're strong, I'll be strong. She took a deep breath. The prison authorities allowed her to accompany us as far as she could. And that's how this story begins.
In the first days after Isabel came home, once the euphoria wore out, reality sunk in. This was going to be hard. Isabel wasn't like other 4-year-olds.
No conocía un árbol. No conocía niños. Era la única niña.
She had never been close to a tree. She had never been close to other kids. She was the only kid at the prison. She didn't know how to drink from the bottle or with a straw.
Things got worse before they got better. Isabel has long-standing health issues, and a few years ago she suffered a stroke, which left her with trouble walking. Also, Buendía tells me there's been behavioral issues, which he chalks up to those first years in prison. She has an obsession with structure and gets really upset when routines are broken. They've been working with specialists for years. It's been an uphill battle. And in between, normal life happens. And he says it's amazing.
Pero lo que pide, ay, luego es muy raro. Luego me pide unos patines.
And she asked me for these roller skates. And they were so hard to find. And then I was like, why did I get her these skates? She's going to kill herself. She won't let the skates go, though.
Isabel's mother has about 15 years left on her sentence. By the time she gets out, Isabel will be a young woman. They still talk on the phone, but as time passes...
Ella ya luego no quiere hablar. Y nosotros...
She doesn't want to talk to her mom anymore.
Buendía says he makes her call. He tells her, she's coming back someday, you know, and you'll be together again. He reminds her that nothing is forever, even though he wishes it was. For The World, I'm Jasmine Garst in Mexico City.
You can listen to all of our stories from the series at PRI.org. And over on our Across Women's Lives Facebook page, you can continue the conversation. Just head over to Facebook and search for Across Women's Lives. We're going to spend the next few minutes talking about A Moment in the Reeds. It's a movie set in Finland, and it caught our attention when it screened recently at the Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston. It was the opening film for Wicked Queer, Boston's LGBT Film Festival. Mikko Makala is the director of A Moment in the Reeds. Just start by describing the movie for us. What's the story?
It is a romantic drama about the chance encounter of two young men from very different backgrounds by the lakeside in the Finnish midsummer. So the characters are Levi, who is a Finnish literature student who's studying in Paris and has come home for the summer to help his father renovate their summer house. And Tarek is a recently arrived asylum seeker from Syria who has also been hired to help with the work.
This is your first movie, Mikko. What made you want this story to be your first story?
Well, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, when I moved out of Finland myself, whether I was going to make my first film in Finland, I would have said definitely not. But the main reason is that whilst Finland has been socially and certainly in terms of legislation, quite a progressive country, or at least like to think of itself as a progressive society in terms of gay rights and that, we haven't really had a gay cinema or a queer cinema, and there hadn't been any feature-length queer narrative films. So I really wanted to give the audience that kind of story, but I didn't want it just be a story about gay issues, I also wanted to look at how ethnic minorities experience living in Finland, and particularly because I started to write the film at the start of 2016. It was just after the sort of the peak of the migrant crisis in Finland, and there was a lot of xenophobic rhetoric going around society, and also some good responses, but I also really wanted to look at that and counter that with the film.
I mean, there is a big part of the movie that's about people having to flee to become who they kind of truly, sincerely are. Levi has to go to Paris to kind of be a gay man, and Tarek has to come to Finland from Syria for his safety and to come out.
I always felt that it's not fair. And if I just get on a plane and, like, just go to other places, I can be just myself. I can be accepted and respected.
I know the feeling.
I think it is related how a society treats their minorities, all kinds of minorities. That's why I really wanted to, in this film, have that sort of intersectional approach and look at the potential and need for solidarity between different groups who are on the margins for different reasons.
There's this push and pull as well. You've got Tarek, the Syrian refugee, telling Levi, the Finn, they can't be together because the country means such different things to them.
Hey, Levi, I don't want to see this country the same way you see it. I have to believe in it. It's my home now.
It's interesting. I mean, you're speaking English because this is the common language for a Syrian and a Finn. How do you see Finland today in 2018?
Well, I think Finland in 2018 is quite different from, you know, the Finland that I personally also chose to leave behind in 2007. It has come a long way in terms of, you know, gay rights and the overall sort of feeling in society, an acceptance that's given to you by mainstream society. There are lots more openly gay celebrities, and it feels very different. Mm. But certainly, I think Finland has a lot of issues with racism, and because it's been a country that has been so isolated for so long and hasn't really had much immigration, so a lot of people have just been, you know, scared and like, and really not understanding people who come from other countries.
Which brings us to Levi's father. Let's hear this moment from the film. He's talking to Tarek, the Syrian.
And you, I'm not gonna pay anything. You don't know anything about building. Go back to Syria. We don't need you here.
We should say that the father's relationship with Levi, his son, is really not that much better. Is it kind of attitudes like that that made you go to England in 2007?
Absolutely, because I grew up very close to where the film was filmed, in a pretty small town, you know, full of people who I felt to be, to various extents, homophobic, racist, and I just didn't feel like I had much in common with, if anything.
What kind of reception has the film gotten in Finland?
Well, we haven't shown the film in Finland yet, so it's quite interesting because we premiered it in London and have been going around Europe and Australia and now the US. Mm. But we do now have a premiere set for the summer, and are also planning a small theatrical release in Finland, and I'm really looking forward to screening it there because I did make it, as much as it has been appreciated abroad, and I'm so happy that it has been, I really did make it as a response to Finnish society in particular, and as a challenge really for mainstream Finland to acknowledge the diversity that exists within the country.
So it's almost activist cinema in a way, but it's now in these film festivals, fairly mainstream in the US, not just gay festivals. And then there's the Hollywood success of Call Me By Your Name. Do you think we're at a point where gay love stories can just be viewed as love stories, or does it get a little complicated because it is kind of an activist cinema?
But I do think that there is still, whilst a lot of films like Call Me By Your Name, for example, like, have garnered a great deal of media coverage, there still seems to be a bit of a, you know, the limit to their commercial success, and they're not making $100 million at the box office, but much smaller figures, which does suggest that not everyone is open to those being huge mainstream successes. And also, I mean, in the case of Call Me By Your Name, for instance, it is still a bit problematic, I think, that both actors are straight men. And we haven't seen that many, if any, hits of gay cinema where the actors have actually been gay themselves.
And in your film, are both Levi and Tarek gay?
Yeah.
Do you want someday to leave England, go back to Finland, and be like there as a Finnish filmmaker?
I don't think I would want to move to Finland permanently. But I am absolutely interested in making many more films in Finland. I quite like the idea of being kind of in between the countries and occupying that space, because like with this film as well, I do feel that you have a different perspective when you are looking at something from the outside, having been on the inside before. So I would definitely want to make more films there as well.
Mikko Makkola, director of A Moment in the Reeds, thanks for coming in. Great to meet you.
Thank you very much.
The next screening for A Moment in the Reeds will be in Cleveland, Ohio. That'll be tomorrow and Saturday as part of the Cleveland International Film Festival. And that is our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.